All right, good morning to everybody. We'll start the class in about 2 minutes, continuing with Koheles today. Good morning, Doug. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Rabbi. And we got a gang on the phone.
What's that?
The gang on the phone.
The gang on the phone, okay.
I'm sorry, was Josh, you're there, and who else? I'm sorry. Belinda, you're there?
Excuse me, yeah.
Okay.
All right, so we left off last week. How's the sound, by the way? Okay?
Yeah, you're just fine.
Okay. So we left off last week. So it's chapter 1, verse 16 is what we're up to. And we see that King Solomon is analyzing life and the various involvements, attitudes, actions, the whole array that a human being is involved in, and he wants to share with others, and as he'll say in this next verse we're going to start, but based on his wisdom he wanted to examine different things. Previously, last week, he talked about actions of man, and how what man went after in terms of his activities, that as Ibn Ezra said that he wasn't able to seize on to it with his hand, meaning it was an intangible. And we were saying that this is an example of this is when a person is looking for a certain image in his mind about being great, certain fantasized feeling of satisfaction, happiness that he projects onto activities. Those are the intangibles. And when a person makes up a fantasy, of course, it's perfect. And reality is not perfect. Precisely for the reason that God wants to deter a person from investing his energies into the physical world and all its pleasures as an end in itself. And we mentioned, I believe, also that was the curse God gave to Adam, that when he would sow the fields, he would always be reaping thorns and thistles. That means there'd be a lot of aggravation in the physical world, as Rabbi Chaya explained. Because he had put his energies into this fruit of the tree, as opposed to listening to God's command. So he elevated his estimation of the physical world far and above what God had told him to do. But there's many attitudes, assumptions that man has, and he is exploring it. King Solomon is exploring it. So now we're up to 1:16, where he says as follows. He says, "I've spoken to my heart, or with my heart, saying, behold, I have become greater and have added more wisdom than all those that were before me in Jerusalem. And my heart saw much wisdom and knowledge." So he's consulting himself. He's thinking about something. And he's reflecting on a certain concept. That he became greater and increased in wisdom over all those that were before him. And Ibn Ezra says that the matter of him becoming great and increasing his wisdom, that he gathered and learned from the knowledge of those who were his predecessors, and he added on to their knowledge. And he said that my heart saw much wisdom there's a number of different interpretations on this. But let's just stay straight with the verse that he was, the first thing he was contemplating, the fact that he had increased his knowledge over others. So what exactly is that he's doing when he writes that down? And he goes on and he says, "This is I added on to the knowledge of all those before me in Jerusalem. And my heart saw much knowledge and understanding, much chachma, a lot of wisdom and understanding." And 17, he says, "And I gave my heart to inquire, to know wisdom, and to know halelus, which is folly." All right. Rashi explains it to mean like a confusion of the mind. Tir of das, like his mind was completely unorganized. But there is a certain attitude, he was looking at this type of involvement that people are in, and he was exploring it. See, again, in 17 he says, "The etna libin, I gave my heart to know wisdom." Now, of course, it says he already knows more wisdom than all those that preceded him. So what is he doing here? And to also know, I guess we could say the word should really be expanded to examine, holelus. According to Sforno, holelus means that to know the knowledge, the wrong ideas of predecessors. Okay, and the third thing he looks into is called sichlus, which Rashi explains to mean just stupidity. And he says, he concludes that verse and says, "Shagamzehu Ryan Ruch." This is also a vexation of the spirit. And that's an interesting phrase, because he said that earlier too. He talked about a vexation of the spirit, and we explained that to mean, like we quoted a few minutes ago, that this matter, that Ibn Ezra says on 14:114, this matter of ruach, meaning the wind, or spirit, he says that man is not able to grab it with his hand. And my suggestion as to what he means is that there is a certain projection, a certain assumed satisfaction. So these are the intangibles that I'd like to use as the explanation here. It can also explain it to mean that the spirit of man, the energy, and when he doesn't get what he wants, it drains him. Ruach, at the end of 14, and he says everything is futile and it's an evil spirit. That means it drains man. It's something which is so dissatisfying, so frustrating. But here he's not looking at the actions. Now he's looking at something else. So let's see if we can categorize what he's doing now. And the end of the series of the verses we'll do today is one more verse, which is 118. And he says the reason why there was a vexation of spirit is because with the increase in knowledge, with wisdom, the increase of wisdom, there was much anger. And when one increases his knowledge, it increases his grief, his pain. Now, without the commentators, it's very vague. Because a person here, King Solomon, who God came to in the visions and asked him what he should give him, and the one thing which King Solomon asked for was wisdom, yet you're confused as to how he could then reject wisdom. So it has to be explained. Let's look over the verses for a moment, and then we'll try to take it step by step.
Reflecting on
his status, that he increased knowledge. But he rejects it in the next verse where he says that I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know folly and to investigate also the lifestyle where one is just living very, very stupidly. He's comparing different lifestyles. As opposed to before, he was not. He was comparing different, he was discussing actions of man, pursuits. So it's important that we classify each one of the topics that he is addressing, so we understand how his, you know, these are, you know, give us a point of reference, a context in which we can understand his assessment as good or bad, you know, the value that he puts on it. But I think there is one thing he says, and he talks again about that he was greater in knowledge. He had a knowledge, more wisdom than those that were before him in Jerusalem. So he specifies Jerusalem now. And take a look also that when he talks about how there's verse 18, where he sounds like he's rejecting the path of wisdom, he gives a reasoning. He says, "For in much wisdom is anger, and with increased knowledge there is increased grief, pain." So Ibn Ezra says as follows. He says, when he sought to know syphilis, here he says, was syphilis according to Ibn Ezra is knowledge, seichel. So he says, kasher bikesh ladas syphilis, when he sought to know syphilis. He saw that the one who has understanding recognizes the matters of the world with the abundance of his knowledge. And then he was frequently visited with anger and with pain. And he didn't derive any pleasure with building, because he knew that its end would be death. And he knew also that this would not help him or save him in any calamity. And death is planted between man's two eyes. Interesting statement. Okay. And Rashi says that this syphilis is really just the opposite. It's really shtus, he calls it, foolishness. And he says, so I know, King Solomon says, I know now that wisdom also breaks down a person's spirit, because with his increased wisdom, a person will rely on his wisdom, and he won't distance himself from that which is prohibited, and that will bring much anger before God. So the much anger in verse 18 is God's anger, according to Rashi. So he says, when a person counts on his wisdom, he doesn't distance himself from prohibition. And it brings a lot of anger before God. And he gives an example how this happened. He says, I said, I will increase horses, which the Torah says the king is not supposed to do, because lest you'll bring the people back to Egypt, which is the place where there was abundance of horses. And God didn't want the Jews to go back to Egypt. So God made a command in the Torah that the king should not increase horses. But King Solomon said, no, I'll increase horses, and I won't return the people, because I'm confident. I won't return the people to Egypt. And at the end, he did return the people there. He gives a second example. I will increase wives, and they'll not turn my heart aside, as the Torah says that they will. And it was written upon me already that his wives turned his heart away. So he's saying that this was a foolishness. But what I think what he's getting at, and again, like I mentioned last week, it's a difficult book. But if you notice, and again, we have to be, keep in mind that he asked God for only one thing. When God said, "Ask what you want, and I'll give it to you," so he asked for wisdom. So you see that he valued it. But I believe what he's saying here is wisdom in a certain context, and that is he spoke about himself as being king in adding on knowledge of all those before him in Jerusalem. I mean, he's not talking about knowledge per se, he's talking about in the context of his earthly existence, and I think that's what these verses are addressing. For example, it says in another case that, like we just read, that a person will not be able to be glad with the building of a house, let's say, because he knows the end is death. So what's going on here is that the barometer of this attitude, and this is not his attitude, this is a person whose barometer of value is all gauged, it's all gauging that which is under the sun, as we said earlier. So if that's the context in which a person is trying to derive happiness, even from a life of knowledge, so then it's terminal. And one of the commentaries also says that too, that it's bothersome that he will meet, and he says this openly, but he brings it into here also, meaning that he and the fool both meet with the same end. They're both going to die. So that's a futility, he calls later on. But it's only a futility if a person is only gauging his value on earth, meaning Jerusalem. And you see, he's talking about his knowledge relative to others. That's all on earth. Right? He says, I spoke in my heart, and I said, behold, I have increased and added on to my wisdom on all those before me in Jerusalem. So it's relative. So if a person is going to be using this level of wisdom but limiting his assessment to his earthly stay, so then he's going to have a lot of anguish. Because he can be enjoying something right now, but a real chacham, a real wise person, he is not ignorant of the outcome. That's why it says in Ethics of the Fathers that who is a wise person? One who knows the outcome of his actions. So King Solomon's whole life was before him, and he saw, yes, a person could get overexcited about this. And like we said last week, a person will say, oh, this is new, this is exciting. A person will be looking for areas in order to get that happiness in life. But if he's limiting his assessment of the happiness to this life, he sees how it ends. And like he says, and if it ends with that, the day of death is placed between man's two eyes, meaning it's undeniable reality.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So does that mean that if there were no world to come, that Solomon would suggest that a different life on this earth would be more appropriate? In other words, the life of Torah is not the best life for this world?
That's a good question. But evidently, if it comes to an end, then it really mitigates the value, because then you're not involved in what is really good. There was there's a verse we say, we might have mentioned it before, that when a person goes to the cemetery and they bury a person, so one of the things that we say there is that man, whether he is a day old or if he lives 1,000 years, so it's not of any value. Meaning, if there is a term to existence completely at death, and that's it, there's nothing further, so what's the difference whether the person was involved with a good life? But if it's coming to an end, what I believe it's saying there is that it is it really removes the value of it. Meaning to say that that which is defined as good must be also eternal. That's synonymous. The good is synonymous with the eternal.
I would agree that if you're looking at the end of two lives, and one lived 1,000 years and one lived a day, you could say, well, what difference does it make? But there might be a huge difference in the quality of those lives while those people were alive.
Well, again, if you look at the end, that's really what you really have to look at, the full scope of the existence. And if it comes to an end in either case, so that removes the value, because only that which is, it's, I really have a hard time putting my finger on what the definition is. I tried to go further and I couldn't. I came up with the realization that that is the definition. I mean, if you want to define what is good, it must be eternal.
How come it says in, you know, the sheet, like every day says that, you know, everything is good, and it's not talking about the physical world?
Come again?
In creation, every day Hashem says that's good, and it's really talking about the physical world.
Right, it's good if it's used for the person's eternal life. If it's used as an end in itself, so that was the whole question the rabbis had on King Solomon, that he said that a kol hevel, hevel havolam, amokalas, a kol hevel, hevel havolam. So the rabbis say on that verse, that's the second verse in this book, that he if you count up the number of times he said the word hevel, using the plural forms and the singular forms of the word futile, it comes up to 7. And the rabbis say what King Solomon was saying is that he was indicating, in a subtle hint, that that which correlates to 7 is futile, meaning that which is creation. Creation was in 7 days. And King Solomon was saying that the physical world is futile. So the rabbi said, how could he say this? God says, like you're saying, Naomi, that the physical world is good. This is what God said. So how could man reject that? So they answered, and the answer was, Rabbi Chait explained, that the physical world is good if it's used as a means. But King Solomon was saying the physical world is a futile endeavor if you're using it as an ends. And again, this and all the other verses we've done so far corroborate that if we're looking at just the scope, the spectrum of time on Earth, and that is the entire barometer, so really there's no benefit. A person lives a day or 1,000 years. He's living the good life or the bad life. And that's what King Solomon said. That how can it be that, where is that verse? He says, in chapter 2, 13, so he says that I also see that there's a great benefit to wisdom from foolishness, like there's the benefit of light over darkness. A wise man's eyes are in his head, and the fool walks in darkness. And in darkness, and I know. Then he says, "But I do know that one occurrence visits every person." And I said in my heart, "As will be the end of the fool, so also it'll visit me." Meaning death happens to us both. And then he says at the end of the verse, "Therefore, why have I become wise anymore?" And he says, but I spoke in my heart, and I said, this is also foolishness. This is futile. When he says this is futile, it means to say that this approach is futile. To assess your worth merely based on your earthly existence. Right? And he says, oh, what he's doing, I believe, is verbalizing the attitude of people in order to catch a person's ear. So that's the method that is used. And we said last week also, that's what Kalev did too, when the spies came back and they incited a riot and everybody, you know, was swept up with the fear of these giants that were going to eat us alive. So they were ridiculing Moshe at that point. So Kalev had a very clever plan. And he stood up and he got everybody's attention and he said, is that all Moses did to us? So they thought that he was going to rank on Moses even more. So he used that opportunity to still them, and they'd listen because he went with the flow of their energies, that they were angry at Moses at this point. And he says, is that all Moses did? Didn't he also bring us down the Mon and give us the water and split the sea and so on and so forth? So he used the momentum of the people to get them to listen. And then he turned it around, or at least he tried to. So you can't say that he's rejecting wisdom. Again, you got to keep in mind that this is what the one thing he asked of God. And he knows about Olam Haba. So how can he make a statement that there's going to be one end to both myself and the fool? That isn't the true end of a person who's righteous and lives a good life according to the Torah. Correct? So he's really verbalizing another opinion. The opinion of people that he wants to educate.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Haven't we, though, gone into, or, you know, learned that the Torah life is the best life on this earth? And yes, there's a world to come, and that's going to be whatever it is, but when you look at what's the best life here, the Torah life still is the best life because of the nature of man and the way he's constructed and so forth. But it sounds in this like Solomon is saying, if it weren't for the world to come, you might as well just eat, drink, and be merry, and, you know, and ignorance is bliss.
Right. So the question is, can we say that there's a value if there's no life of the soul afterwards? Is there a value just living that life here? Well, I don't think that that's a good question, because then it wouldn't be Torah. If the soul isn't as it really is, so you can't ask about a new case. You're like saying if water wasn't wet, so then could you use water for X, Y, and Z? But then it's not water anymore. So you're using the wrong definition. You can't say if water isn't wet, then could I use water for something else? Then it's not water anymore. Then you're not talking about water. So you can't say, well, man didn't have the next world, so would man have still the best life here, but then it's not the same man anymore. It's a whole different creature. And again, going back to what we say in burial, so there it voices the point that whether a person lives a year or if he lives 1,000 years, it is as if he never existed. That's what it says there. Because if something does come to an end, so how can you give value to it? Meaning to say, once the person has expired, after let's say even 1,000 years. You can't say there was some worth to him because there's no him anymore.
So he does say it seems like he says in 2:13 and 14, you know, that wisdom exalt Kali, light exalt darkness. You know, the wise man has eyes in his head, and the fool walks in darkness. And it seems like you're saying there's something better there. You know, even though he goes on to say, you know, the same thing happened to both of them.
Well, that could be that he's looking at one angle, but that's not a conclusionary statement, 13.
Right.
Look, on the one hand, yes, I see that there is benefit here, but then he says that is all thrown out the window if both people die, and there's nothing afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult, because it's a powerful question to say, well, how could you say that, well, if a person didn't have a soul after Earth, well, why can't we still say that the Torah life is better? Well, better in terms of what?
I would argue that it's better in terms of the experience the person is having on the planet. I mean, in one, if I look at it this way, if I have two people and they each live 100 years and one lives let's say there's no soul, okay? And one lives a life of enjoyment and pleasure, and the other, for whatever reason, is in constant chronic pain. And then they both die.
Right.
I could say, well, afterwards, from the perspective of death, you could say, well, what does it matter? They're both gone. But while those lives are going on, I'm sure that the person who is experiencing the pleasure would say that his life is a more enjoyable and pleasurable life than the one who's constantly in pain.
I don't know about that, because if you're saying that there is no existence afterwards, so then what is it all for?
Yeah, but I'm not talking about what it's all for. I'm just talking about the experience they're having going along.
But you can't do that. If you really want to assess the value of it, you cannot just stop time. Because time doesn't stop. It's not the... I don't feel that's an accurate assessment. Yeah, I could look at two people right now and just freeze frame the entire world. And I guess say, you know, here's a righteous person who's going through a certain amount of suffering because he doesn't have all the physical. And then you have another guy who's very wealthy, and he's in the middle of having a great meal. And if I just look at those two moments, well, I'll say that the anguish that the righteous person is having is just not as pleasurable. I mean, it depends, again, what your context is. So you would say, well, you can't just measure on that, because the person who's just a glutton, really is nothing's going to happen to him at the end. He's just going to lose his soul. You know, we agree that there is a reality that time doesn't stop, and that the value that you give to something momentarily is not a good assessment. It's not an accurate assessment.
But don't we also learn that the Torah life is the best life a person can have now, and also in the world to come?
But that's only because there is a world to come. It's the best life now because he is now, his soul is now benefiting. The soul, which is an eternal thing, is benefiting. So once you say that the soul is not eternal, now you're no longer talking about the same human being anymore. Or the same Torah. It's not the Torah anymore. I know it's a difficult idea.
Seems so that if you're living your life with wisdom and making decisions based on consequences, then you're going to avoid a lot of the pain that living a life based on your emotions is going to give you.
But again, you're measuring it based on the momentary earthly existence. But you're not looking at the fact that where does it end up? See, if there is no future, if the soul person just completely evaporates, if all human beings, they just have an earthly existence and they're gone, so that's the very sentiment of whether you live a year or 1,000 years, a day or 1,000 years. You're like one who never existed. That's what the Siddur tells us.
I think the person who has a lot of wisdom would be more depressed because he would be more in touch with the reality that he's going to die one day. And he would actually have a worse life, maybe.
Yeah, but again, we're talking about facts which aren't true. So we have to be careful that there is no if we don't exist afterwards. We do exist afterwards. So we have to look at the whole, the reality, right? We're trying to understand truth here. And truth is that we do have an existence afterwards. And that's really what makes the life here a good life. You're right, Doug, about the fact that not only is Torah the best thing for the next world, but it's the best thing here. But the here is not divorced from the next world. The rabbis say in the Talmud that this life is like the vestibule before the big banquet hall, and the big banquet hall is the next world. I mean, they realize that this existence that we have is really nothing compared to what the next will be. It's really a state of preparation. And the rabbis say a number of times that a person who prepares for the Sabbath eats on the Sabbath, and a person who doesn't prepare for the Sabbath, he goes hungry. That's what they say right here. Let me just find it. Yeah, we did this last week. It says that which is crooked cannot become straight. That which is lacking in number cannot be numbered. So what does it mean that which is crooked cannot be made straight? It cannot be fixed? So one of the explanations Rashi gives, he says, is that b'chayav, in your life, that which is crooked in your life, you cannot fix once you die. Meaning, once you die, you can't go back again and redo, right? Which is a very good proof, you know, against the people who have this theory of reincarnation. You know, they call it Gilgul of Neshama. That is, you see here, Rashi says openly that which is crooked in your life, you cannot fix once you die. I mean, it's a warning, and he says one who toils and busies himself on Friday for the sake of preparing for the Sabbath, he's the one that's going to eat on the Sabbath. And the rabbis explain, this is about Haba. Excuse me, the rabbis, they give another explanation afterwards. But this is one view. So you see how this life, you can't divorce it from the next life, because the soul's existence is something which continues. It's an enduring thing. So you can't talk about the soul as something which stops. Then you're not talking about the soul anymore. They're talking about a new fantasy of what, you know, human existence might be. So, if a person really comes to a real end, so again, the Siddur says that. I mean, it's a difficult thing, because we should still say, well, isn't he still doing something good here, the Torah lifestyle? I mean, what's the use of it? Just a few decades. Then what? I mean, he's trying to show that the real barometer of value is always associated with that which is eternal. If something is a good, it has to be eternal. It has to be tied to God, which is eternal. I forget who it was. Recently I saw one of the commentators who talked about that when a person is involved in truth, so then he gives life to his soul. So you see, he's involved in truth here. So the real value is that he's making his soul a endless existence. That's the real good here. So you can't divorce the next world from here. I think that's maybe a better way of saying it. The real good here is that you are invigorating your soul with eternal life by being involved with eternal truths. So when he puts down, when King Solomon rejects certain attitudes or lifestyles here, it's all, as he says, I looked at myself and I said, I have become more wise than those that were before me in Jerusalem. You see, he's creating the context of the earth. Meaning, if I assess my value, but it's based on relative, it's just based on the earth, meaning those who came before me on earth and living in Jerusalem, and I have much knowledge. But then what happens is if I assess the value even of knowledge, and even if I assess the value of foolishness or folly, he says that it becomes it drains the spirit. It's a vexation of a soul. And like Ibn Ezra says that he knows that the end will be death. So if that's really the attitude, that a person feels that the end is death, and that's his true end, there's nothing afterwards, he's right. So what's the benefit of all? If I'm coming, that's what he says. What is it he says later on, right? He says in 2:15, and I said in my heart, as will be the end of the fool, so also will it visit me. And therefore, why did I become wise? This is addressing your question, Doug. Why then did I become additionally wise? So I really believe that he is verbalizing these attitudes that man has. And he goes through the whole book doing this.
So you would say that he's commenting on the basis of the populace that might look at it as, well, there's just this life. And in light of that, what's the point?
Right.
Okay. I get that. Thank you.
Yeah. Just give me one moment here. I'm just going to look for something. Rashi says again in 17, he says, I now gave over my, I looked in my heart to know the good of the benefit of wisdom. And what is its end? So you see, if I assess it, he says, based on what is its end, so that completely mitigates its value. I mean, in Maimonides talks about it, I think in the Laws of Kings at the end, that with the good that's stored up for the righteous, so that's the old, you know, the next world, and they looked forward to it. That's the real good. All right, let me see if I get his wording. Second. Swerner says also that, this is on verse 2:17. He says at the end of his commentary that because something expires, this is why it is futile. Right, under the sun. On the words in 17, he says, "And I hated life, because it was evil upon me, this mice, all these doings that are done under the sun, because everything is futile and it's a vexation of spirit." So what does it mean under the sun? Because it is lost, it's eventually destroyed, and with this it is heaven. This is why it's futile. But he knows that he has an enduring soul. So again, he's verbalizing the feeling that people will have, they really look into it. But most people are following an illusion that there is no end. That's why they can be happy. But he's now saying, no, stop that denial. Look into it. If you're really looking at what you are projecting, you're saying it's going on forever. No, it's not going on forever. I mean, the physical world doesn't end in itself, but people today are just chasing. They constantly need to replenish because they see after this trip. So then they need another trip, and they buy this car, they need another car, and whatever the physical objects are that they're so conditioned to chase after, because it's an illusion that this next one will now be it. That will be the thing. Again, every fantasy is perfect. Nobody in their fantasies has any scope of time. There's no, they don't see it ending. They don't see the car getting that first scratch, or somebody down the street buying a nicer car the next day. Or the fact that this fantastic trip they're going on, they got seasick on the cruise ship. Whatever it is, fantasies don't include anything negative. Now, he's telling you that if you're looking at it that way, it's wrong. It's illusion. And that's why you think that you're going to be happy. But if you look at it in reality, the physical thing is then going to expire. Then what? In other words, don't look at this as what is going to give you happiness. He's really popping the bubble of people's fantasies, but he wants to redirect a person. So where is the happiness going to come from? But you see what he talks about. He talks about the anguish that he has in 2:18. "And I hated all my work that I worked upon." Under the sun, again, under the sun. He's showing you that his assessment of what's good and bad, if you look at it as completely a temporary earthly stay, so then you're going to have a lot of anguish. He says, because I'm going to leave it over to somebody else. Meaning the whole enjoyment I had, at least in my work, even if I didn't use it, so I'd leave it to somebody, I'd benefit. No, but if I'm going to make so much money and then I leave it to somebody else, that bothers me now. But that only is bothersome because you're limiting the context of your evaluation to your earthly stay. If a person realizes that he won't have these concerns for the physical when he's gone, that he could divorce himself from that type of a thought. A person could really come to terms with the fact that after this short stay on earth, I will not have concerns of the earth. So then this is not going to be a bothersome thought that I work so much and somebody else has it. It's only bothersome because a person thinks he's going, it's the thinking he has right now. Any questions, comments?
No, that makes sense. I mean, if we take Saforno to his logical end, I mean, he's saying because nothing expires, that's why it's futile. So if you really thought it through, well, and I guess this is what Solomon's saying, everything you're engaged in would seem futile unless you have some concept of something enduring.
Right, meaning everything which a person does, you know, when the rabbis describe a righteous person, everything he does is for the sake of getting closer to God. So that means everything he's doing is really for the bigger picture. It's not, he's not living just for the moment. And there was a rabbi in the Talmud that he was very upset because he left over a few pieces of carob when he was about to die. That means he worked a little bit more than what he really utilized. So that was excess. And that labor that he put involved in something that really didn't benefit him at all, so that bothered him. Because that was, there was no real purpose to that work that he did, because he's not using it. Perhaps it's a very sensitive understanding of you know, how much they were really concerned. I mean, I think Rabbi Akiva was the one who said his whole life he wanted to know how he could really serve God, like the Shema says, with all my soul. And I think he was the one that they burned or they flayed, and he was now, when he was dying, he was saying the Shema. So now he knew how he could love God with all of his soul. The feel not the Nishma soul, that even if somebody takes your soul, so in that, he did not reject the Torah. And he uttered the words that God is one. So even to the, I'm bringing it up because even to the point of such pain, but that was really not something that he valued. Look at Abraham. He was able to sacrifice his son. For so many years he had no child, and now he finally had one. And God says to sacrifice. You see that his love of God, his love of reality, far surpassed the love of what was temporary, the love of his son. And even after God told him, don't kill him, now I know that you really fear God, he went on his own and sacrificed something else, meaning he did not want to lose the opportunity. He didn't recoil and rejoice, oh, I've got my son back, because that was not what he really valued. He truly did value God. So it was something which he did out of a love, and he got up early in the morning to sacrifice. So it wasn't like there was any type of problem. And the Talmud does talk about that on his way, the 3-day journey to go to Mount Moriah to sacrifice Isaac, the Talmud talks about a metaphoric discussion that Satan had with Abraham, meaning he says, you old man, are you foolish? Have you lost your senses? And he was trying to, the instincts are still there. And I think that another one talks about that he walked in, the water was like up to his nose. Another way of saying that there was a battle, but he still had a stronger attachment to God than to his son. So it's not to say that he was an insensitive robot, but the value, you see that the value of those people on that high level, their value is not this life. That doesn't mean that they weren't. They were the most charitable people, though. I mean, you know, Abraham, the whole thing about him was that he always invited guests, and he always took care of them. He stood over them, and he waited on them. And then he went out and he taught people. He was concerned. But the real concern he had was that they should also share in that eternal life that God really prepared for every human being. So that was the real chesed. That was real kindness that he showed, was to try to help people, save them from following idolatrous lifestyles that would terminate their souls when their body dies. To help people get past their own illusions by doing it himself and showing, this is what I did, I experimented on myself, but this is the attitude that I have, and exposes the fallacy to them. used himself as the actual. So he was the subject of the experiment. He was also the observer. But he shares with the reader these different attitudes and disappointments, but exposes them. And so you may have this type of a disappointing sentiment, but that's a futile thing. To be worried that you're leaving over your money to somebody else, that's a futile type of a worry. Because that worry doesn't continue in the next world. Think it over. If you want to read further, I think it's a good idea to start seeing more of the chapters. So it'll help in terms of contrasting what we're doing in the current chapter. It may raise more questions for us to better refine. Meaning, let's say he says something in chapter 4 that sounds similar to what we're doing now, so then we'll be forced to better define what we're doing now. Contrast is always. That was the whole book of Proverbs. Every verse there is, each verse has a similar concept, but slightly different. There's one concept at the beginning of the verse and another concept at the end, and they sometimes sound identical, but that's how he approaches. That's how he educates a person, by giving them two things which are slightly different, and then, now show me the difference between the two. That's how you sharpen your mind. A person, for example, wants to know the difference between colors. You don't show him black and white. That's very easy to determine. You show him maybe like a pink and maybe like a very bright red, and then a person has to see, oh, this one has a little bit more orange, and this one has a little more yellow in it. So when you have two things that are very similar, then it forces you to draw out what is really the defining features of both. So the same thing with the verses. But I understand that the assessment of Torah we think is always absolute, but once you take away the next world, then you're not talking about the same human being or the same Torah anymore. So it's not even an accurate question. Wouldn't the Torah still be good for man if he had no soul after this earth? No, because it's not the Torah anymore, and it's not the same man anymore. It's a subtle point, but you have to recognize that. I mean, that's what Moses told the people, choose life. He wasn't telling them to choose life on earth. They were already alive. He was telling them that when he was about to die, that I'm placing before you goodness and life and evil and death. But choose life, he says. Choose the life of the Torah. Because that's what's going to give you real life. All right, any questions before we end for today?
I think we're good here, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I'll look into this more. Maybe we can try to bring it to more of a head. Maybe look at other verses and see if that would help clarify it too, right? But you see the idea, though, that the real assessment has to be with the full range of human existence. And that's here and the next world. That's the only real assessment of what's good for man.
Yeah, I see the point.
Okay. Well, I'll try to look at this more, and again, let's see if there's more verses that can maybe bring this out better. All right?
Okay.
Okay, then. All right, so we'll pick up again next week. Have a good week to everybody.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.